وهاب جميل وهاب لطيف كواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Welcome back to a new episode of Back to Reality. Dear listeners of IRB English Radio, I am Asma. I have the honor to be your host for today's episode. And here with me, I have Brother Muzaffar and Brother Hassanain. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you very much, Jazakallah.
And thank you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you very much for having us in the studio.
Yeah, that's a pleasure to have you both in here. Well, before we start, just like the ritual of this program, I would like you to introduce yourself very much briefly.
I'm Muzaffar Haider. I'm from the UK and I'm studying in the Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Yeah, that's very great. And you, Brother Hassanain?
I'm Hassanain and I'm from India and I'm studying in the Islamic Seminary of Qom.
So I wish both of you too much of luck and prosperity.
Jazakumullah.
Well, so as we were studying in the high school and even before that, there was a special book being put among our books, and that was the religious book that taught us many things about our religion. And still, I guess that was not enough of religious studies in our education. So as for today, we are going to talk about the role of religious education in modern society.
Yeah, that's a good thing about Iran, that you also, you know, you also thought about the basic ideas of Islam in the school.
Yeah.
Like while you're still in your, you're studying your sciences and all, mathematics. So we did not have any such books like Islam. So when we are kids, we get to know about Islam from our families and from the Islamic
schools. The books you read, perhaps.
Yeah, and the books we read and from the majalis and member and all. That's the idea where children usually get about Islam.
Yeah.
That's the thing where children are first made aware of Islam.
Exactly. So you, brother, did you had religious studies before getting to seminary?
I had one religious class when it was called RE, Religious Education. And that was in primary school.
Yeah.
So I was 9. Mm-hmm. And we learned about Hinduism, Sikhism, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam.
So still it's helpful because you get to know about other religious
ideas. Yeah, I mean, I love
No, you get the gist of it.
Yeah, the gist of it.
I was always fascinated by it. Like, why? What do these people believe? What do these people...
Exactly.
It's always been interesting.
Yeah, so generally speaking, knowing more about other religions is going to be something really funny and interesting. But the question is, do we need to have a special religious education during our schooling or after our schooling in order to know more in this modern life?
They need to have a basic knowledge about their religion. You know, of course, like at some point of life, you know, you might seek Islamic knowledge. But, you know, since beginning, you need to be aware of it. But when you get across doubts, when people create issues regarding Islam, and you're not ready for that.
Yeah.
And that makes you doubt your own religion.
Exactly.
Just because just the matter of fact that you don't have knowledge about it. But if you had a pre-knowledge about it, you would have, you know, just, you know, solve it on your own. So there should be an idea about Islam, about religion, since, you know, I guess, you know, their young age, like maybe at least when they're near to the age of puberty.
So at this very first step, I would say that we need to have religious studies because life is not going to go always smoothly. And you think you're a religious person, but and the first impediment that gets into your way, you might lose all your creed. And then you might get to the point that, okay, what I'm thinking about, what I'm believing in is not just maybe the whole truth. So let's keep it in here, go for a short break, and then we'll dig deeper.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Yeah, this is Back to Reality. Brother Hassanin and Brother Muzaffar are in here to talk about religious education that we should get in this modern life.
I think people should seek themselves about what the religion says and find out themselves. Whenever they come across an issue or a doubt, they should be able to pick up a hadith literature and just go through it and find out the answers for themselves or go to a scholar.
There must not be a religious education and I should go for it whenever I feel the need for it.
So you agree that there has to be a religious education?
Religion is very vast. Which parts? You know, fiqh, aqaid, ahkam, which philosophy?
About your everyday life.
That would be ahkam then, right?
Yeah.
Brother Hassanain is talking about when you encounter a doubt in your religion. Mm-hmm. None of these aforementioned things that we just talked about deal with that.
No, why? That helps you, you know, solve your own queries. Like, you know, when you come across a doubt, when if you have study about aqaid, you know how what the answer for this doubt will be?
We were arguing here that this Islamic sciences, right, should be taught alongside what we define as secular sciences. Although the reality is that all knowledge is, in a way, Islamic, right? All we're learning about in school is basically either the words of God or the actions of God. You know, the words of God would be the Quran, the Ahlul Bayt, etc. The actions of God would be physics, right? Because you're seeing how Allah acts in this world.
The manifestations of it.
Yeah. So we are not necessarily giving students the tools to go and find the answers for themselves. When I was doing teacher training, for example, we got taught something really interesting. They said, don't teach children what to think. Teach them how to think.
Yeah.
Right? So what's happening right now is, I'm not talking about Islam here. I'm talking about generally because in the West as well, Muslim Shia communities have schools and they teach them little bits of Islam and this and that. And I think it's all good. But I'm just questioning here the entire system where we have youths who are, you know, they're actually not being able to think in the right way.
Yes.
You know, they're not logically comprehending the religion. Lots of the questions that they have are still, you know, very baseline.
Yeah, so for that, they need an education, right?
What kind of education?
You mean the theoretical education?
So for example, when you're talking about aqaid, right, I agree with you. If you study aqaid, then you'll be able to answer a lot of those issues. Mm-hmm. But again, it's limited because when you're designing a curriculum for an entire class, you have to be very general. You know, what is Tawheed? It's this. What is Nubuwwah? It's this. What is Qiyamah? It's this. What is Imamah? It's this. Okay, you have to be very general. Now, the youths are being attacked from a completely different angle.
These are the basics. They have to know them.
They might have to know them. But I'm saying a step after that is about getting them to learn it themselves, is what I'm saying.
What do you mean by that?
So, there are certain things in the deen which actually promote the idea that you should go and learn, you know, those things should be taught to them. For example, the ethics in Islam when it comes to a teacher. You know, if students learnt those ethics and how you're supposed to behave with a teacher and how you're supposed to see your teacher as a kind of father figure I'm just saying, if a student knew that, how well equipped would they be going into the world? Think about it. They would, if they came across any problem, they would now be able
to go and approach a scholar and ask questions. Yeah. What we're having right now is a kind of stagnation mm-hmm. where students have learned certain things about Islam, which mm-hmm. are the very, very basics, right? Which even a non-Muslim knows pretty much.
Yeah.
And whenever they're facing an issue in life, they're shy to ask a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
They think, oh, I'm not going to ask a scholar. Do you see what I'm saying here?
Yeah.
We haven't taught them how to think. For example, teach them how to go to the hadith books.
All the point you have mentioned comes back to a point which says that, you know, there needs to be an Islamic education. So that was a point I was trying to mention in the beginning, right? When the question was asked, like, what is the role of Islamic education in the era of modern education?
No, but it's very easy, Brother Hassanain, to just say, yes, we need an Islamic education. And this
there's an answer for that.
Yeah.
Like, first of all, we need to look, what is modern education teaching you?
Dear listeners, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Up until now, let's go for a short break and I'll be back in no time.
Sister, you're studying English literature, right?
Yeah.
What have you learned?
A lot of philosophy, a lot of...
You're in university now.
Yeah, okay. Now I have finished university.
Alhamdulillah. Prior to that, how did you get to university? Did they teach you, this is what this poet says, this is what this writer said? No.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're able to figure that out yourself.
Yeah.
What did you learn when you were younger?
Well, I went for it myself.
But you were taught how? You were taught how to read and write.
Yes, of course.
How to think analytically.
Yes. But don't you think it's something individual? I mean, the thing I did was something that came out of my mind. Why my other classmates were not just interested?
It is, but we're talking about the education system here, right? I agree. You put your own efforts into it. Of course, that it comes down to the individual in that
okay,
sense.
Okay, I guess you're questioning over the system of education.
Yes.
Not the Islamic education itself.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the point.
Well, initially, okay, look, I just said that to play devil's advocate that I was saying, you know, we don't need Islamic education. We do need Islamic education.
Considering what Brother Muzaffar said, what do you think? If we just teach our children, the students,
mm-hmm.
the main sources in order to get the answers for all the issues that might happen to them?
Okay, like first, like in the beginning of the show, like where I pointed at the issues that we face or the doubts we come across, there was just like one of the factors we require Islamic education for.
But I think it's a really important factor, though.
Yeah, it's one of the factors, but not the only factor. So what I meant was, you know, where do children get the knowledge about Islam from? Like, the first thing is their parents, right? So what, even the parents in today's world, they might not be that well Islamically, you know, educated. Like,
exactly.
So, you know, what's the main source of their knowledge? What did they get knowledge from? You know, people usually get their main Islamic, their source, main sources, you know, at least at the beginning stage, when they get to know about Islam. Like, first is their parents, and then the mimbar. You know, no one in the beginning starts, you know, takes Quran and read the
Fasir. And then, of course, the media is also working out in here.
Yeah, around, you know, it's, you know, the environment, like, whatever... they get from the environment, from across their living.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a main source of Islamic education, right? So, as a question, again, you know, once again, thinking about the question, like concerning the question, like, what is the role of Islamic education in today's modern education? So we have to look what modern life is teaching us. Today, how, you know, the rich people are controlling the minds of the world. You know, what are they inserting in people's mind? And this all this new propaganda of LGBT and all. So this... all this crap is being served to you. Where have ethics gone? Like, where
yeah,
has...
Yeah, so for the need of the today's requirements of the life, we have to know more about our religion.
Exactly, and the main part and the main role of Islamic education is the identification between right and wrong.
Exactly.
It helps you tell, like, what is right and what is wrong.
Yeah.
So that's the reason you need Islamic education. You know, all the crap you're being served in today's world. Like, how are you going to defend it?
a person at their 20s, they need to have some religious studies because they are so, I don't want to say ignorant, because they do not know many of the things that is related to their religion. So if they get with an issue, if they are confronted with a problem or issue related to their life, they don't know how to answer it regarding to their religion. That's why I guess this modern life needs more studies.
You're saying that the solution is Islamic education.
Yeah.
Okay, what is that?
The Quran and Ahlul Bayt.
Ahsanta, what is that? That's Islamic education,
hang
right?
Hang on.
As Muslim people who are living in this modern life and there is too much of things in our plate, we need to know more about our religion.
Yeah.
Now, there must be a special system for that. We have to work on it, and it's not just going for through theoretical things and the story is done. No, we have to go for more of works in there for special teachers, perhaps, for a special kind of method to teach students about religion and so on. But still, the thing which is very much clear, and we have to take it as a fact, is the thing that we need to have religious studies in order to get more prepared for our life.
We have reached a certain point, I guess, that it is required.
And
the thing is, how is it supposed to be implemented?
Yeah, right.
And that's it. This is all the time that we had for today's episode. I hope you just enjoyed it. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
The Era of Trumpism.
Part 2.
If products do not get across borders, soldiers will be crossing them.
The sheer unpredictability of a President Donald Trump.
How unpredictable the new terrain here in Washington is.
Is this our new normal? Is there reason for concern?
The creation of a new reality.
Donald Trump has broken the rules of what it means to be president.
What Trump are we going to see, do you think?
Going to constantly have rules that are broken in my way or the highway.
If we call it a political earthquake and unraveling of the system.
Now, in order to figure out how Trump wanted to use his expertise and skills in marketing and negotiating in the political sphere, we'd better take a glance at the list of his advisors. Harold Hamm, a renowned American capitalist involved in the field of oil and gas business, the 39th richest person in the United States and the 98th richest person in the world. Daniel Ralph D'Amico, the former chairman of Nucor Company, the biggest producer of steel in the world. Stephen Turner Mnuchin, an investment banker, film producer, and chief of financial affairs in Trump's election team. Stephen Ross, a Jewish billionaire involved in real estate development. Howard Mark Lorber, a Jewish capitalist involved in real estate development and one of the business leaders in the tobacco industry. John Alfred Paulson, a Republican billionaire. Peter Navarro, the only academic economist in Trump's team of advisors, and the only economic policy advisor to Trump who has a doctorate degree in economics. Navarro is also an expert on trade with China. Stephen Moore, an economic analyst and a main figure in the conservative Heritage Foundation research institution, which is known to the public as an advocate of capitalism. It is interesting to get to know some of the well-known international brands which Trump used their leaders as his economic policy advisors after winning the presidential election. In fact, the important issue is not that Trump chose these people as his economic policy advisors. What is more important is that the managers of these brands run the president's strategic and policy forum. Trump's unprecedented decision, though not being new in the history of the United States presidential elections, brings up numerous questions due to the present conditions in the country. Trump, anyhow, has taken power into his hands.
Do solemnly swear.
This person, despite being an alien in the world of politics, is considered to be an international player in the field of trade, entrepreneurship, and marketing. Is this a new playground drawn by think tanks advocating the West's capitalist system, led by the United States of America? The president had promised to take tough measures against countries that had breached the international trade deals with the U.S. and slap new tariffs on them. In addition, he vowed to file complaints at the World Trade Organization against countries that violated the trade terms. In this regard, Trump pointed his finger at China, claiming that that country had imposed unfair fiscal policies to manipulate exchange rates and control its currency's fluctuations.
China!
What China has done to the United States, it's one of the greatest thefts
in the history of the world.
But I'm going to instruct my Treasury Secretary to label China a currency manipulator.
Trump has set competition with China as a top priority of his administration's foreign policy. This issue can not only have an impact on the U.S. economy, it can also create financial challenges for the global economy as well. This is because after World War II, China's economy became dependent on U.S. financial resources, and the U.S. economy became dependent on China's workforce and resources, creating the foundation of the world economy following the Cold War. China, on the other hand, has publicly announced that it is not in favor of a trade war with any country, not even the United States. However, it added that if a country should ever decide to engage in a trade war with China, Beijing would be prepared for it, and it was fully confident that the Chinese nation would prevail. To this point, everything seemed to be normal. However, what made it unusual was that Trump chose a provocative title for his program, and his decision to actually launch the program made it even more absurd. Trump announced that his economic policy would be to make America great again. And to achieve this, he would place U.S. economic interests first and foremost above other factors in outlining his administration's foreign policy in regard to globalization. He chose U.S. first as his campaign slogan. However, the question that comes to mind here is that is it possible for the leader of the globe's capitalist system to take a stand against globalization? During the election campaign, by stating economic slogans in line with protectionist policies, he managed to gain the vote of non-Americans, Muslims, Mexicans, and immigrant labor forces, in addition to the traditional conservatives. He also bagged the votes of those who were unemployed, as well as the victims of layoffs in previously industrial states. The workers in these states, which traditionally supported the Democratic Party, had been made redundant after U.S. companies moved their businesses out of the country. The U.S. states that lost their industries were known as the Rust Belt states. Trump got their votes.
We love Nevada. We love Nevada.
In reality, these were the people who had become disillusioned with the liberal democratic system governing the country. The system, based on democratic liberalism, also had other limitations in the U.S., which led to Trump gaining more votes. The most important factor was the influence of money and the candidate's direct or indirect connections to big corporations and financial institutions, as well as the wealthy people and industrial groups in society. Trump believes that the United States of America is facing demise due to the mistakes the U.S. made in its foreign policy, in particular the U.S. commitments to international deals.
The Iran deal was one of the worst and most one-sided transactions the United States has ever entered into. Frankly, that deal is an embarrassment to the United States, and I don't think you've heard the last of it.
Failed wars and multinational trade deals. Trump believes that the role played by the U.S. in the process of globalization has been financially detrimental to the U.S. citizens. To fight this, he believes that the current political order must be put aside. Now, is this good news? It is really strange that the elected president of the United States of America, who is at the helm of the capitalist system, opposes globalization. One of Trump's campaign slogans was America First.
It's going to be only America First. America First.
However, Trump and his team do not explain how they plan to carry out their promises in the current exiting structure of globalized capitalism. How do they plan to manage direct investments abroad by the United States and other countries' investments in the USA? How are they going to deal with monopolies and multinational firms? If other countries retaliate, what will become of U.S. digital industries, which have notable presence across the globe? Protests in Trump's America indicate that he is facing many problems in the political structure of the country, and his rivals are urging him to not change course from traditional U.S. foreign policy. What will the result of this political push and pull be is unclear. The legitimacy crisis and contradictions inherent to the liberal democratic system will exacerbate the situation.
Put the whole thing to bed earlier this year.
Another contradiction lies in Trump's protectionist policies, which obviously run contrary to the strategies pursued by international capitalist institutions such as the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the World Trade Organization, which the U.S. has played an important role in the establishment of. For example, how can the U.S. impose tariffs to stop the imports of goods from other countries while urging the return of local investment and not expect to see any reaction from foreign countries? China, the European Union, and Canada have already announced their commitment to free trade and warned that they would retaliate if restrictions were placed upon them by another country. Trump has not clarified how he would be able to stop the digital industry giants like Microsoft, Google, Facebook, and others from investing across the globe, given the huge profits they have reaped in from globalization. Undoubtedly, these companies will be the main ones opposed to Trump in comparison to the governments. Trump's use of his expertise in business and marketing is not limited to China alone. For example, a Trump advisor has promised Britain that as soon as the country pulls itself out of the European Union, London will be placed at the top of the list ahead of others in future trade deals with the U.S. Trump has attempted to limit trade with some countries in the world. But why? Right after he came to power, Trump started to take a number of risky moves. One of those moves, which he had promised during the election campaign, was to withdraw the U.S. from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was signed by a dozen countries after 7 years of negotiations. It is natural for a president of a country to cancel a deal due to unfavorable conditions for that country. However, this deal was set aside at a time when Trump had not yet offered an alternative deal and simply said that the U.S. had better not deal with these countries. Trump has tried to renegotiate the conditions of all the deals that the United States has signed with other countries, attempting to revise them. Initially, there were rumors about the cancellation of NAFTA, a trade deal between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. Shortly later, however, it was announced that he wanted to renegotiate the terms of the deal. Trump did the same with the internationally signed Iran nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA.
I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal. In a few moments, I will sign a presidential memorandum to begin reinstating U.S. nuclear sanctions on the Iranian regime. We will be instituting the highest level.
The important point here is that by observing a small portion of what Trump's America offers to the world, one sees that it is none other than the White House itself which is opposed to the liberal world order. On the other hand, it justifies why the U.S. considers sanctions as its most effective tool in a direct economic war waged against Iran. Because this way, Iran is forced to limit its trade deals to just one or just a few countries. This limitation has made the Iranian economy vulnerable, forcing it to do one-fourth of its trade capacity with one trade partner alone, namely China. Meanwhile, Iran is among the top 20% of the world economies. Its population is 1% of the global population. Given these facts, Iran should be doing between 1.2 to 1.5% of world trade. That means it should be doing three times the trade volume it is doing today. On the other hand, despite having no trade with the U.S. and not being a trade partner to that country, economic changes in the United States caused by international trade do impact businesses and economic trends in Iran.
Americanism, not globalism, will be our credo! Will be our credo!
Nevertheless, the prescription that will pull us through the crises caused by the globalization process is achieving the goals set in the Iran 1404 Outlook document, general policies related to resistance economy and growth plans. A local prescription that will take us safely through the era of Trumpism during the globalization process.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be looking at a very interesting question. And that question, a lot of people ask this question, you know, and that question, it's a question that nobody knows the answer to without the help and assistance of religion and revelation. Because science doesn't really, can't really tell us anything about this. It's impossible for them to kind of, you know, learn about this or tell us anything about this through, you know, sensory experience and these kind of things. And that is, what happens to the souls of human beings when they die in the purgatory and in the grave? First of all, before we get to that question, let's kind of analyze what the meaning of the purgatory is. In one verse of the Holy Quran, we read that, ahead of them is a barrier until the day they will be resurrected, which kind of alludes to the fact that between death and the resurrection, there is an intermediary state for the believer, which they call the purgatory. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, "By Allah, I fear for you the barzakh, the purgatory." He was asked, "What is the barzakh?" He replied, "The grave from the day one dies until the day of judgment." Right. So this is the response to the question regarding what is the barzakh. Now, the question we would like to address today is what exactly happens to the souls of people in the barzakh. So let's divide this topic into two subcategories, two subtopics. Let's first analyze what happens to the souls of the believers in the purgatory, and then we can see, maybe if we have time, to see what happens to the souls of the disbelievers in the purgatory. Fortunately, the answer to this question has been answered in religious texts, and we have an answer for that in the form of verses of the Holy Quran and Hadith. In one verse of the Holy Quran we read, do not suppose that those who were slain in the way of Allah to be dead, rather they are living and provided for near their Lord, which indicates the fact that the souls of the believers, at least specifically the martyr and the people who are slain in the path of Allah, they are taken care of, they're alive, and they are provided with, and they are proximate to God. They're in a state of qurb and proximity to God. In one hadith, we also read the following: the souls of the believers will be in chambers in paradise, eating of its food and drinking its drinks, and visiting one another, saying, "O Lord, bring the final hour so that you may fulfill what you promised us." Right? Which kind of indicates the fact that these people will enjoy some of the blessings of paradise, but it will be an incomplete enjoyment, and then, you know, these people will be anticipating the completion of their rewards on the day of resurrection, and hastening and praying to God that God would hasten this. Regards to the souls of the disbelievers in the purgatory, when and what happens to them? The answer to this question can also again be found in the form of a hadith from Imam Sadiq. He said that the souls of disbelievers are in the fire of hell, exposed to it, saying, Our Lord, delay the final hour and do not fulfill what you warned against us. This is a contrary to and in contrast to the first hadith. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at what happens to the souls of the believers in the purgatory. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Everyone has a beloved, a new dear friend. But I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio. For those who seek the truth.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum.
Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
We are looking at the issue that what does it mean to be the Shia of Ali? And the way of answering that question is to look at the companions of Ali. And so we come to one of the companions, Miqdad. Again, Salman, Abu Dhar, Miqdad, Ammar, these are the people who were known as the Shia of Ali during the lifetime of Rasulullah. Miqdad bin al-Aswad, his actual name is Miqdad bin Amr al-Bahra'i. He was an Arab from an Arab tribe between the Arabian Peninsula and Sham those days. And because of the strife and problems in that area, his father migrated to Mecca. But you know, during the old days there, if you are an outsider, you would not have your security of your life or property unless you attach yourself to one of the local tribes. And they become your halif or kafil. Those who have worked in the Middle East, you know. If you want to even start a business there, you have to have a local partner. And there is no guarantee he might take away everything and legally you don't have anything. So he's your kafil, basically. Once you are attached to him, then his protection would be extended to you also. So Miqdad's father, when he migrated to Mecca, he became client, this is the term used, mawla, halif, of the tribe, the clan known as Abu Zuhra of Quraysh, one of the tribes in Mecca. And so this person from Abu Zuhra became his kind of sponsor. And with that, you know, now he would have all the privileges and security and safety to live in Mecca and do his business. And this person's name was Aswad, Al-Aswad bin Abdul Zuhri. Later on, this sponsor ended up adopting Miqdad. And according to the Arab tradition before Islam, you know, his name was now changed, Miqdad bin al-Aswad. And that's how actually even he's known even now popularly. Later on, when Islam came and Islam abolished the system of giving the name of other people to, you know, your family name, then he again became Miqdad bin Amr al-Bahra'i. He's among those who became Muslim during the very early days. Among the first seven people, Miqdad is counted among them. But because he was adopted by this Zuhri family clan, he could not publicly, you know, support Rasulullah or claim that I'm a Muslim. He lived in Taqiyya. Until the opportunity came in the first year of the Hijrah that he was able to join a group of Muslims under Hamza, who were around, you know, close to Mecca at that time, coming from Medina, just as a surveillance group, you know, the military mission they had. And this is where Miqdad joins them and basically runs away from Mecca and goes to Medina. He was a very courageous fighter from before Islam. And because of that, you know, he also participated in all the battles with Rasulullah, and he had a very, you know, active role. Especially, he was known to be somebody, a champion on, you know, fighting on the horse. So he was sometimes known as Faris Rasulullah. And he also was many times assigned the duty of guarding Rasulullah during the battle time, so he's also known as Haris Rasulullah, the guard of Rasulullah. However, the good quality of our Miqdad, and this is something we have to keep in mind, you know, having a sword or knowing how to, you know, fight is not sufficient. You should also understand your cause. You should be a responsible fighter. Why you are doing this? And there is a very interesting conversation between Miqdad and Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wa sallam. which is also quoted besides our own books, even in Bukhari. And this is a hypothetical situation that Miqdad is asking Rasulullah. And it's a living question because it's relevant to the Muslim world even now. He says, Rasulullah, if suppose I'm fighting with the kuffar, and, you know, I am there with this kafir, we are fighting against one another, and then for a moment he is able to gain upper hand, and he cuts my hand. But then I attack him more severely. And he jumps and goes on the tree, on the branch of the tree. And when I'm very close to end him and kill him, he says, Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah, ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulullah. What do I do at that time? Now look at the circumstances. Of course, this guy is just saying it to save his own life, because he was fighting him. He even cut his hand. And Rasulullah says, you can't do it. You can't kill him now, because he said the shahadatain. And Miqdad said, but look at the way he was fighting with me. He even cut my hand. Rasulullah then says, Miqdad, if you kill him after he says, La ilaha illallah and Muhammadun Rasulullah, then your status will change. Your maqam will change. He will be in the place of a Muslim. You will be in the place of kafir. So this issue of sanctity of a life is very important. In warfare, of course, you will fight. But if the opponent ends up and saying, La ilaha illallah Muhammadun Rasulullah, even it might not be, you cannot really know what is in his heart and mind. But once he utters the kalima, you cannot kill that person. But what is happening there? In Syria and Iraq, look at the attitude of those who call themselves Islamic State. Look at in Afghanistan. Even in Pakistan, to some extent, even now in the Afghan-Pakistan border. These are the people who are killing, not just those who are saying, La ilaha illallah, Muhammadun Rasulullah. They actually go into the masjid to kill them. And this is where we come to realize that, you know, this is how they have moved away from the true image and teachings and values of Islam. If you really want to see what is Islam, look at the Quran. Look at the teachings of Rasulullah. Look at the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. Look at people like Miqdad bin Aswad. They are our role models and examples. Another very interesting description of Miqdad from Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salatu wa salam. Where he says, إِنَّمَا مَنْزِلَةَ الْمِقْدَادِ بِنَ الْأَسْوَدِ فِي هَذِهِ الْأُمَّةِ. The position or status of Miqdad in this ummah, كَمَنْزِلَةِ أَلِفْ فِي الْقُرْآنِ. It is just like the status of Alif, the first alphabet in Arabic. He says the way Alif there is in Quran, and then he describes it, La yalzaqu biha shay. When you write Alif in the beginning, you can't join anything with it. It's by itself. And if you write Alif later on, after some other alphabets, it will be the last one. Because if you join that with something else, it becomes lam in between. When you join lam, you know, it's connected to one side and the other side. But if it's alif, it will be there by itself. And so this is where the sixth imam is saying that the position of Miqdad is very unique. He's by himself.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen Ghafur
شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Midstream.
Did not put the fate of our countries and peoples in the hands of the foreigner, but we bet on the victory of truth in the end, and we won the bet. This is how Syrian President Bashar al-Assad addressed Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi during the latter's visit to Damascus last week. The Syrian president's words summarized the origin and depth of the bilateral strategic relationship that linked the two allied countries since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979. At that time, Arab regimes were moving to a position that contradicts and confronts the aspirations of Syria and the Arab Liberation Forces, leaving Damascus alone and facing the projects of the American and Israeli colonialists and their tools that began to multiply in the region. Also at that time, Iran was moving from the position of the exclusive agent of the colonizer and the guardian of his interests in the region to the position of Palestine, to where Syria stood. Therefore, it was necessary for the hands to extend between the two historical capitals to intertwine together to bet on what was right. Syria has borne a lot of blame and clear Arab official pressure because of the position late President Hafez al-Assad took when he opened his arms to Imam Khomeini's Islamic Revolution in 1979 and stood by Iran during the 8-year Iraqi war against the Islamic Republic. The Arab regimes allied to the colonialists never forgot that position. Not because of jealousy over Iraq, of course, but because the Syrian-Iranian alliance that developed over the subsequent years to form a practical axis of resistance in the region included all Arab and Islamic movements against the colonialists and the forces of hegemony up to the defeat of the Israeli enemy in southern Lebanon in the year 2000 at the hands of the most prominent Arab resistance force that arose from the womb of this axis. Because this alliance was and still is posing a great danger to the forces of dependence and surrender associated with the projects of Western powers in West Asia. Therefore, when the Western war on Syria began in 2011, Tehran did not delay a single moment in joining Damascus in its war, in which it was intended to destroy the last Arab country that said no to colonialists and raised the matter of resistance and liberation in its face. Iran quickly entered the field through military advisors, trainers, and volunteer popular groups that were sponsored, trained, and armed by the Iranian state to fight side by side with the Syrian Arab army and unite with them in a baptism of blood that moved this alliance to a new level of brotherhood on the long and grueling road of resistance. For all this, President Raisi's visit comes in its official form, duration, and the way it was received in the Syrian capital from the airport to the People's Palace as an explicit declaration of the victory of this alliance, which is led by Tehran and Damascus over one of the most dangerous projects that targeted the two countries and the region for decades. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The The Iranian presidential plane landed in Damascus last week, carrying President Ibrahim Raisi, accompanied by a large government delegation, in the first visit of an Iranian president to Syria in 13 years. The timing of the visit seems to be the most important of all, without diminishing the importance of the agreements signed between the two countries and the transition of cooperation between them to economically advanced stages after its security and political contract was completed during the years of the war. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Laith Maarouf, political commentator. Thanks a million for being with us, Laith, to discuss this very important visit to Damascus. I mean, at the height of the moment of Arab openness towards the Syrian capital, Damascus, the visit of the Iranian president, Sayyid Ibrahim Raisi, to Damascus carried several messages in many different directions about the relationship between Syria and Iran, about Iran's position, basically, on the Syrian political map and the directions of cooperations ahead between both states in both the near and the far future. I am interested in learning what messages this visit sent, especially to the regional players.
Well, it clearly came out before the expected re-entry of Syria into the Arab League and before any peace treaty is signed between Turkey and Syria. So what does this mean? This means that the most important relationship that Syria has with any regional country is Iran, and this visit was a message to all the Arab countries that are trying to court Syria back into the Arab League and to create relations again. Remember, Syria has been in alliance with the Iran since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Syria has been offered billions of dollars and trade and taking off the sanctions if it gives up the resistance in Lebanon and its relationship with Iran over the last two decades since the war in Iraq that happened multiple times as offers from the United States. And today, as Syria emerges victorious from the global war on it, led by the United States and its local vessels, we see Syria reaffirming its relationship with Iran, that it will not move closer to Arab states or give up its relationship with Iran after all this war.
Well, I was interested in listening to what Syrian President Dr. Bashar Assad had to say when he received his Iranian counterpart. He basically said that when the war was launched against Syria 12 years ago, Iran did not hesitate to stand by Syria. And then he added that the two leaderships had bet on the victory of truth. And in the end, they both won that bet. But at what cost, though?
Well, obviously, the cost of resisting imperialism and occupation is very high. But the cost of surrendering to a colonizer, to an imperialist power like the United States, is even higher. We can see clearly what happened to Libya, what happened to Iraq, and what happened to any other country that gave up in the face of invasion. So Syria did pay a huge price for protecting its sovereignty and its dignity, but it definitely, that price was cheaper than being currently occupied by Wahhabi Contras or Israel or the United States directly. So this was the only choice in front of a Syria that wanted to stay sovereign.
Was it the only choice for Iran as well?
Of course it was the only choice for Iran. Remember, the United States, after its invasion of Iraq, had a plan to destroy seven countries in a row, and the last country in that list was Iran. And of course, the war of 2006 on Lebanon was to defeat Hezbollah. It was supposed to be followed by the war on Syria, as we saw, and for a crushing of Syria, for eventually Iran to be left alone in the region, and where Israel and the United States would attack it with its regional vessels. Of course, luckily, thanks to the perseverance and resistance of both Lebanese people and the Syrian people, that plan didn't come to fruition. And Iran today is safe because Syria was victorious, because Hezbollah was victorious.
Well, Well, the Iranian visit came as a clear and direct response to the Israeli enemy as well, just like you just referred, which for years has been working towards the goal of expelling Iran from Syria in various direct and indirect ways. The most prominent of those methods that Israel played is the battle between wars policy, which aims in an essential part to create some sort of a discord between the Syrian and Iranian leadership. How do you see that Zionist war ending?
Well, the battle between wars, this Israeli strategy, is now completely failed. And, of course,